Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The groundbreaking Abbott versus Burke school funding case was initially decided in New Jersey over 30 years ago in 1985. It was the first of a long series of rulings in which lawmakers and the courts attempted to negotiate and clarify formulas to provide extra funding to poor school districts, money which would help to ensure that low-income children receive the thorough and efficient education guaranteed by the New Jersey state constitution. To date, 31 so-called Abbott districts receive supplemental funding. But in September of last year, the latest challenge came from the Christie administration, which petitioned the state Supreme Court for permission to rewrite New Jersey's school funding mandate, and also separately to strike down teacher seniority rules, popularly known as last in, first out. The story of Abbott versus Burke has many twists and turns, and joining us for the first part of the hour to lend some clarity is John Mooney, education reporter and founding editor of NJ Spotlight. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, John.
Glad to be here, Mary. Thank you.
So this go-around, Governor Christie didn't have much luck with the state Supreme Court, did he?
No. He had filed this motion last year basically to, as you said, rewrite Abbott and require that the state only provide a level fund of state aid to every district. It was in the range of $6,500 per pupil, and regardless of need, regardless of income levels and the like, really wanted to shake it up. And it was a long shot to start with. It was, as you mentioned, it was part of a petition that would also have reopen the rules around seniority and LIFO, and there was not a great sense that he was going to have much success on either of them, and the court last week, basically in a one and a half page ruling signed by the Chief Justice Stuart Rabner, said they're not going to take up either of them, basically punted the LIFO case to a lower court if they want to pursue it there, said that's the place to pursue that, and really barely addressed the Abbott piece of it, the funding piece of it, and basically makes it now, I think, pretty much a moot point, certainly with the governor having less than a year to go in office. I doubt highly that he's going to be pursuing this much further. But it was, you know, good headline for a little while, and I think he got the traction he wanted out of it. Yeah. And if the court had gone with him, he, you know, obviously would have been a big victory. But even turning it down, I think he moves on.
Well, let's take a look at Abbott closely. This is obviously not the first time that, political entities have gone after this particular decision. I think, well over what, close to 20, perhaps? give us a bit of the backstory, if you will, to Abbott versus Burke.
And yeah, again, I mean, it dates back even further than 85. It started under the Byrne administration, it was Robinson versus Cahill at that point, and basically was brought initially by, and Abbott is actually the name of a Camden High School student at the time. I think it's Raymond Abbott, since grown up, but he was part of a class action suit that was brought by something like 30 families throughout the state, led by the Education Law Center, the advocacy group out of Newark, and basically saying that the state was not fulfilling its obligation under the Constitution to provide a thorough and efficient education to all students. And so they brought this case, one of the first, and these cases have grown up in multiple states since then, but New Jersey was one of the first, if not the first, to bring this case. And it has been a back and forth with the state Supreme Court ever since. It led to our first income tax in the mid-70s under Governor Byrne. The court even shut down when the legislature was not moving fast enough on that. The court even shut down the schools briefly for about a week, albeit it was in the middle of summer, so the impact wasn't great. But the court was, you know, quite aggressive on it and has had a multiple ruling since then to strengthen, and much to the chagrin of some governors along the way. But since added that universal preschool be provided in these districts. And at one point was even dictating, or at least trying to dictate, what kind of instruction in terms of what kind of models.
So,
and real activist court on this case.
So what has Abbott versus Burke done for these districts? You mentioned the universal preschool. There's also a school construction, a huge school construction and renovation program. What else?
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly, there's a lot of questions of what have we gained out of Abbott. There's a lot of money now being spent in these districts, no doubt. You know, several of them well over $20,000 per pupil. And certainly has brought some resources to these districts that they didn't have before. Nonetheless, it is, you know, educational improvement is a very stubborn act, and it's not just, you know, clearly it is not just about resources, but a multitude of things, including the challenges faced in a community. And part of the difficulty is finding apples to apples measures in terms of, you know, how kids were doing back then versus how kids are doing now. Test scores have seen certainly some improvement. You're going to be talking with the Camden superintendent, Payman Rahanafart, after me, and he can speak to some of the graduation rate gains that you've seen over the years. I mean, there's certainly been some improvements, and the pre-K is often cited as probably the biggest success story of Abbott. The school building program has gone slower, and that is, you know, that has been a frustration to a lot of communities. So it is a mixed record. There's no doubt about it, and these schools still struggle in many ways. But the court is clearly making it, you know, taking a stand here, even with some new members appointed by Governor Christie, that it is not looking to reopen this case, at least not yet.
So Abbott versus Burke stands for now. And I know that at one point Governor Christie was going to ask lawmakers to put his fairness formula, as he calls it, I think, on the fall ballot. Voters would decide whether to amend the Constitution so his funding proposals could be implemented. Do you know if that's still knocking around, John?
I don't see any of that happening now. The one wild card in this, and it's really up in the air, and the governor has not shed much light to anybody that I know of, is whether he makes one last stand on this in his state budget later this month. He has a lot of power in that state budget in terms of setting funding levels. Yes, the legislature has to sign off on it ultimately, but schools are setting their budgets now, and those numbers are really turn out to be fairly sacred and don't change a lot over the years or over the months leading up to actually the start of the fiscal year. Now, will he try to, you know, go with his fairness formula in this budget? He might. I wouldn't rule it out. I've sort of said it's a 50-50 chance. But if he does go for it, the legislature will no doubt push back on that. And there's there's conceivably a constitutional battle ahead over that. So it should be an interesting next few weeks as we lead up to that.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. Democratic Senate President Steve Sweeney, Assembly Speaker Vince Prieto, they have, I think, agreed that some changes need to be made to the funding formula. We're talking, what, adjustment aid and funding caps for districts with big enrollment changes?
Yeah, I mean, what happened when the School Funding Reform Act was enacted in 2008 with the court's approval? They did have sort of aid being adjusted per need, and really was in keeping with the Abbott decree, at least in spirit. But what happened as it became law was legislators built in a bunch of different funding streams, including what they call adjustment aid, which is largely called, you know, basically a hold harmless that would prevent any cuts in funding from districts. And those were supposed to be phased out so that it would be equitable and actually the SFRI would be followed, but they never were, in large part because we went into a financial crisis like much of the country after the recession, and they haven't fully funded the SFRA ever since. So those have remained in effect. So we have some districts who are actually getting more than they're entitled under the School Funding Act, while there's others who are getting much less. And overall, it's about $1 billion less going to school districts than the funding formula requires. So you've had this real disparity. And what the legislature under Steve Sweeney and Vincent Prieto both want to try to address some of those disparities. But how to do so?
They're pretty far apart, aren't they?
Yeah, they are pretty far apart, in large part because Vincent Prieto represents at least part of Hudson County, where a lot of those districts that we're talking about that are quote-unquote overfunded might lose some aid, including Jersey City, which is, you know, the second largest district in the state, and it could be as much as $100 million in aid, not right away, over time, but that's, you know, that's fairly untenable politically for him. So he's pushing back on that.
All right. So in the remainder few moments that we have with you, John, Governor Christie was also, as mentioned earlier, taking aim at the last in, first out rules, you know, regarding teacher layoffs. He's been, he's been targeting teacher tenure laws for years. What is the thinking here? I know the justice has told the administration that this would all have to go back to trial level if he wants to pursue it. But what is the thinking here with last in, first out?
Yeah, I mean, that, as you said, it has been a pet peeve, if not bigger, over the years for him. He had tried to get rid of it back when they did rewrite the tenure laws in 2012. He was not able to win consensus, and that law passed, you know, virtually unanimously to get that consensus, including from Democrats. That LIFO piece remained in statute, and it is state law. And he has, you know, he has been fighting ever since to try to get rid of it. It really does put some kinds of restrictions on superintendents who are downsizing. You know, they are going to be losing their younger teachers, you know, by nature, and a lot of them are the ones that they hired themselves. And so he has really made this a cause, and he went to the court. And it was definitely a long shot that they would take this up. I mean, this court is not one that's going to take a case like that without having it go through the trial and the fact-finding and the like. But he was going for it. And again, he got a headline. It made, you know, made some news for a while. But I don't think anybody thought that the court was going to be ruling on this one.
Yeah. And yet Governor Christie does have some support here for change. For instance, I was reading that there's a case brought by a coalition of Newark, New Jersey families. I mean, is it conceivable that over the next year or so, you know, despite the efforts of the powerful New Jersey Education Association, that there could be some movement made on this initiative of Governor Christie's?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly conceivable. I think the fact that it's in state statute and very clearly such, I'm not sure that the court is necessarily going to overturn statute. But it certainly could get some action in the lower courts. I mean, that's how Abbott started. Now, hopefully, we don't have to go through 40 years of this to get any kind of resolution on it. But the courts don't necessarily move quickly. So it certainly there's some merits on both sides, and we could have a whole show on that alone. But yeah. but I don't think it's going to get resolved anytime real soon.
Okay. So again, to recap, John Mooney, before we let you go, Abbott versus Burke. Do you see anything new developing here? Just so, you know, looking into the crystal ball over the next, say, 5 years. Or so with this decision.
Yeah, I mean, the court is a little different than it was in terms of when they was acting on this, and I had thought there might be some movement. The fact that they didn't even speak to it makes me think that at least not yet. But, I mean, there's going to be a lot of pressure on districts and schools and the state as a whole over the next 5 years, financial pressures. We have a horrible pension situation, and it's going to be a breaking point for some school districts. And I don't think this is certainly a dead issue by any means, and I certainly think that the next Democratic legislature and the next governor are going to have to address some of these things, and if they don't do it to the satisfaction of some of the districts, you'll be back in court. So it's certainly not over.
John Mooney, thank you so much for joining us. John Mooney, education reporter and founding editor and CEO of NJ Spotlight. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And as promised, coming up next, Payman Rahanafar, superintendent for the Camden Public School District, is with us live in studio, and we'll be talking to him, so stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Payman Rahanafar is here with us in studio for the rest of the hour. He is superintendent for the Camden Public School District, and we'll be picking up on the discussion regarding Abbott versus Burke funding, also about progress happening in the Camden District, challenges which remain, and a little later on we might go off topic and talk about the president's immigration ban. But first, Payman Rahanafar, nice to have you back with us here on Radio Times.
Thanks, Mary. Great to be here.
And before we begin, I'd like to give out the telephone number for anyone who might want to join the conversation. It's 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So first to Abbott versus Burke, the school funding decision recently contested in the courts once again. Camden is an Abbott district. So Payman, what does this funding do for the students of Camden?
The Abbott funding specifically.
Yeah.
So like you heard from John, there are some real benefits to it, and pre-K is really significant. And so we have, as far as I know, the highest pre-K enrollment rate in the state. So by our data and tracking, about 97% of our 3- and 4-year-olds are enrolled in a pre-K program, full-day pre-K program. And that's just so significant insofar as getting young people in a nurturing learning environment. And that has significant impacts improving their life trajectory in the long run.
So educationally, what do they take from pre-K?
Well,
they learn to start to read.
Sure. So you begin the basic building blocks of phonics and reading. More than anything else, it's just getting kids in that nurturing environment, I believe, and ensuring that those students have social emotional learning supports. And again, beginning to develop the skills they need to be successful in kindergarten as well.
Yeah. So if fewer Abbott dollars came into Camden, then would the pre-K availability, would other programs, would this be threatened? And part two of that is, how would that affect the average student, say, in middle school or high school during the school day?
This has all been a fairly abstract debate from my vantage point. And so we wouldn't want to lose pre-K. We wouldn't want to lose funding for our high school students. So, for example, we have a new initiative this year where we're providing during the school day SAT administration. We waive the fee for our students. We provide free SAT prep. And those are all really important initiatives. And so if our funding were to be affected, those – you know, the details would be really, really critical. At the end of the day, we don't yet know in Camden how much it costs to educate a child at the highest level. We're seeing real progress. At the same time, there are some challenges. And also, we've unearthed a lot of inefficiencies in the system. So I'll tell you, in our first year, we cut $29 million from our non-personnel spend in the central office. And you wouldn't have even known the money was cut.
Really?
Yeah. And so we were, there were a lot of kind of like systems failures. And this isn't to point the finger at any one person or group of adults, but to say there weren't great checks and balances and systems in the central office and control. So, you know, one example is we were paying benefits to employees who had left the district 5 years ago.
Yeah.
We had, believe it or not, dead people on payroll at one point. And so, you know, that sort of thing, like there's a lot you can clean up. And I think the governor, to an extent, has a point in inefficient spending in certain places.
Sure.
But again, the work of educating children in Camden is challenging and complex. And so I think we have just more work to do to really figure out how much it costs to educate a child at the highest level.
So if you could just review for us the complexities in perhaps your district as compared to some of the wealthier districts. What are some of the challenges your kids might be facing?
Well, I'll start with that. I believe our children are no different than children in Haddonfield, Cherry Hill, and the outskirts of Philly. They can attain excellence and have the same potential as all children. I hope that goes without saying.
Sure.
You know, Camden as a city has inherited decades and decades of challenges, starting with a post-industrial decline and the jobs that have left the city. And so, you know, at the root of that, I believe, is institutional racism, which begat poverty. And so what does poverty mean? And it's so regular for us to hear from teachers about outside the classroom factors that affect their work. And I believe that's real. And so for me, when we talk about poverty and we talk about outside the classroom factors, I really kind of pushed our team and our community to really think about specifically what can we do. And there's a lot of research that points to the impact of trauma and toxic stress and how that can manifest itself in a lot of different ways inside of a classroom. And so there's a famous study called the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, that was born out of Kaiser Permanente, which showed that young people who have 6 or more adverse childhood experiences, so that could be abuse, assault, addiction, they are far more likely to suffer from chronic illness, cognitive impairment, social-emotional learning challenges. And so we need to be really mindful of that reality inside of our classrooms, given a lot of our students have been exposed to trauma and toxic stress.
So after 4 o'clock, after 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, what happens there can manifest in the classroom.
Sure, absolutely.
And your district, we were talking off mic, is actually, and perhaps you're unique among many districts in the area, you are reaching out to what happens after the school day to families into the neighborhood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. And so, you know, to the point about kind of the impact of poverty, so 55% of our students live below the federal poverty line. And so that's kind of where the conversation began for us. And the initiative that you're referring to is one that we are trying to better support our most chronically absent students. So in 8 of our schools, the 200 most chronically absent students, and we're talking about kids who have missed, in some cases, 80, 90 days plus in a school year. Yeah. We are visiting them once a week, and we are partnering with this incredible organization called the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers. So it's an organization that's kind of filled with nurses and social workers, and their outgoing CEO is a doctor who actually had a practice in Camden. And the idea is holistic care. We are there to ask questions, to better understand the circumstances of why this child isn't showing up at school, because ultimately that's more a symptom of what is playing out inside of that home. And we want to help drive better solutions for the family, starting with empowering them to drive those solutions. And so this is really hard, complex work, and we're training our staff, and we just launched it formally for 200 students this calendar year. We did a smaller pilot with 13 students last year. And so
what happened with that pilot? Did you find how many of these kids came back?
So the sample size is too small to really draw meaningful conclusions. So I partnered with one family, and
the superintendent partnered with one family.
Yeah,
I'm
glad I did it. I'm glad I did it. I mean, I can find the time to do a weekly visit, and so I think that was a unusually successful case for us. So this student had missed, you know, by March something like 70 days. And as it turns out, there was kind of a two-part problem. He didn't feel safe getting to school. He had a transportation challenge, and he didn't qualify for the busing pass. He lived just below the threshold. And then the other problem was at school, he was getting bullied.
Yeah.
So kind of safety from start to finish for him during the school day. And we were able to address that fairly easily. We transferred him to a different traditional public school where he did qualify for the bus pass. And he didn't miss another day the rest of the school year. Now, the other students we worked with, mixed results. And so we're really excited to launch this bigger pilot this year. We're going to do a more formal evaluation of the program. We've partnered with Rutgers University. So we'll have some real kind of data and evidence going forward.
You know, if these kids don't get into school, if they don't come back to school, what generally happens to them?
I mean, it's a very quick spiral. So, yeah, if they're not showing up, it's pretty clear cut. They don't get to the finish line. They don't graduate with a high school diploma. Completely different life trajectory.
All right. So just a little bit more on the dropout rate. Yeah, I mean, you've been superintendent since 2013, and the dropout rate, you know, even though the pilot's just going into effect now, has gone down from 21 to 12%, which is extraordinary. You know, and also at the same time, the graduation rate's gone up from under 50% to 70%. So that's the really good news coming out of this Camden schools. To what do you attribute these changes?
Hard work of teachers and staff. A lot of systems have been tightened. I think there's better support for our high school students as they prepare themselves to cross the finish line. And so our guidance counselors and our high school teachers and our principals, I believe, have done a far better job of just on a student-by-student basis tracking those students and knowing what credits they need to receive and what pathway they ultimately take to graduate, because there are multiple pathways to graduate. And the appeals process is one that we've really used to ensure that our students put their best foot forward. And so really the credit goes completely to our staff.
Still, overall, test scores are low. So what are your thoughts as to why, and in your vision for Camden schools, what needs to be set into motion to rectify this?
So you're right that the overall proficiency levels are low, but we're seeing progress, and that's really significant. So the graduation rate has gone up from 49% to 70%. We've closed the gap with the state very significantly. Our K to 8 results, grew faster than the rest of the state in ELA and right in line on math. And you know, I think that if we continue to keep our heads down and investing in our staff and our students the way that we have, we'll continue to see that progress. At the end of the day, there's no kind of if you do these three things, that's the cure all, and all of a sudden your achievement levels go up to kind of the state average. But we're moving in the right direction.
So it seems as if it's going to take a while. You feel as if you're moving in the right direction, but it will take a while. How long do you think? And do you see yourself at the helm of this process as it plays out the entire time?
I think that improving life outcomes for Camden children is it's a longer term endeavor, if you will. And I would love to stay here and continue to play the role that I've been playing. And I feel so, so privileged to be able to say I'm the superintendent of Camden for the past 3.5 years. But I think ultimately that this is something that will play out beyond my tenure here. You know, I guess to give you a more direct answer to your previous question as far as what we're doing, I think that one of our realizations has been so much of education policy has focused on our students as kind of cognitive and intellectual beings. And there's so much that we need to do to improve on the quality of instruction and lesson plans being sound and tight and curriculum aligning to our students' needs. There's also the social-emotional learning side of our students. And I think so often we just assume that our students come to us in one form or the other. So you have some positions inside of a school that just address student social-emotional learning needs, like, say, a social worker. And then the teachers are just there to provide sound instruction. And it's really critical that everyone in a school building is addressing both, because clearly you can't separate our students into those two beings.
Sure.
And that's what we're really trying to figure out. So at the highest level, we've invested heavily to improve the quality of instructional delivery. And at the same time, by training our staff, building these unique partnerships like with the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers to ensure that everyone in a school building knows about this other side of our students, which clearly everyone acknowledges, right, the social-emotional learning needs of our students.
So on the instructional side, we were talking earlier with John Mooney about, last in, first out. The governor, of course, he's determined to kind of overhaul that, which newer teachers are often cut first when it comes time to determine, funding. Any thoughts as to how that should be handled?
So speaking just for myself, I'll tell you that I can understand why that policy exists. I'll also say that from the seat of management, I would want flexibility. And so all superintendents, myself included, want as much flexibility as possible because we believe every decision we make is the best decision, right? That policy, however, exists because of the fact that politics can insert themselves in any school. And frankly, management make mistakes, and sometimes things can be arbitrary and capricious. And so when you have turnover at superintendent level, and in my case, I'm the 13th superintendent in 20 years, and you have kind of whiplashing initiatives, I believe there should be a safety net for those individuals whose salaries don't match administrative level salaries. So you're talking about middle class paying jobs, teachers. And I think that safety net does make sense. And so I've never been someone who would say die on the sword for LIFO. It creates certain challenges for us. There's no question. And we've lost a couple younger, higher performing teachers. For the most part, we've been able to navigate around LIFO. That's where I stand on it. Now, administratively, there are certain protections that principals and vice principals have. And that I don't necessarily believe that to be as necessary when you're talking about jobs that pay over $100,000 and are also protected by LIFO.
All right, let's get to the phones. Charles is in Southwest Philly, and you are live now with us on Radio Times. Hello, Charles.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Yeah, I'm a former employee in the Camden City School District, and I heard Mr. Ryan Farr talking about doing some things in the community, but, he did cut some jobs of teachers. His first year cut like 351 teaching jobs. He's also cut jobs from food service, classroom aides, and I would say his record on the bilingual and special needs areas lacking. I worked in high schools where, and in elementary schools where, a lot of these students were not getting serviced, and therefore they were falling through the cracks. So that seems to be part of what has happened for the 2 out of the 3 years that I worked there since he was there. And
you're no longer with the school system, Charles?
I'm no longer with that school district. That's correct. And in addition, real quickly, Mr. Hanifar does come from the Eli Broad system. He's been mentored by those people, and they are definitely aligned with Betsy Voss. I know you haven't gotten to that part of your conversation, but
we have it
coming up.
All right. And actually, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times, because we're actually up against a break here. So, he's got some concerns, and yes, we are going to, we'll talk about Betsy DeVos, I think, after the break. But, you came in and there were cuts that needed to be made?
Yeah, so when we first came in, we inherited a budget where over the prior 3 years, the district had kicked the can. So roughly $50 million of one-time monies were used to plug recurring expenses. And so we basically walked into that. And in the subsequent years, the layoffs, like for example, the last 2 years, not a single teacher was impacted. And there were some other cuts around the edges that certainly impacted people, but not nearly at the level of that first year. So that first year, Charles is absolutely right. And that was a budget that we inherited. And we can talk a little bit about, why there has been a budget impact over the years and the growth of charter and Renaissance schools, because that's, I think, a longer conversation to be had. But that first year budget was anomalous, and we haven't had any cuts at that level since.
Where do you start when you have to cut?
Central office, and we've been pretty clear about that. So we start central office first in non-personnel, and I mentioned that there was some wasteful spending, some lack of controls that led to inefficient spending, and also just a lot of vendors and contracts that weren't really driving bottom line outcomes for kids.
So classroom instructors last?
Absolutely. Yeah, we always cut school-based budgets last.
All right, we're going to be talking some more with Payman Rahanafard, who is a superintendent for the Camden Public Schools. We will talk about the confirmation of Betsy DeVos and lots more straight ahead on Radio Times. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Keep it here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are joined for the rest of the hour by Payman Rahanafard, who is superintendent for the Camden Public Schools. And again, lines are open at 888-477-9499. And Payman, going into the break, we had a caller, Charles, who brought up Betsy DeVos, who, of course, was confirmed Tuesday as education secretary. And it came under some fire during the confirmation process because she apparently has limited experience with the public school system, more with charters and vouchers, the vouchers allowing students to use taxpayer money for tuition at private schools. During the campaign, Mr. Trump called for a multi-billion-dollar voucher initiative. So how does the landscape shift for Camden's public schools if something like this is put into place?
Something like this in terms of the vouchers, voucher policy?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Honestly, I mean, at the federal government level, there is only so much impact you can have in education. Education is fundamentally controlled at the local level, states and districts. And so, that's what I've been telling friends, colleagues, family who have been asking me about her appointment. So I just don't see things meaningfully changing. And if there's anything she kind of said cogently during her hearing, it was that she's going to defer to the states.
All right, so let's get to the concept of the Renaissance School. This is a model, publicly funded, privately managed. It's a model that's working for Camden?
We're seeing results.
And why is that?
Well, the reason I believe it's important to invest in Renaissance schools and to have utilized them as a major kind of tool to help improve outcomes in Camden has to do with the belief that in the district for a very long time, and I mentioned up in the 13th superintendent 20 years, there was always a lot of turnover and turmoil. And It's not just unique to Camden. You see this in other urban school districts across the country where there is a mandate for change because the results deteriorate over the course of years and decades. And so everybody wants to see improvement. And as it turns out, the work of improving schools is not an overnight effort. And so what happens is these are all like really, really well-intended stakeholders. So you're talking about school board members to commissioners of education to superintendents to so on and so forth, like all the elected officials. And so because those seats end up being pushed by a new slate of candidates that say, well, I've got the answer or I'm the superintendent that has the better solutions, that turnover plays out. And so what happened in Camden was that there'd be one curriculum 1 year, 2 to 3 years later, a new curriculum, 2 to 3 years later, a new program and initiative. And even just having so many superintendents in a short period of time, all the staff in the central office get shuffled around. And so you get the idea.
Yeah.
And what a Renaissance school provides is an organization that has a self-perpetuating independent board. Their meetings are just as public as our board meetings. But the board itself is insulated from politics and insulated from kind of that whiplash of initiatives and programs. And they become learning organizations where the decisions are focused in on children and not necessarily kind of the politics adults may bring to that setting.
And there's a certain consistency then? Is that what you're saying?
I believe it's about consistency and sustainability, yes. I want to also really acknowledge and be clear about the trade-offs there because there is a very palpable sense of disenfranchisement through certain parts of
Get to that,
and
community.
Yeah, and that's real. And we very much weigh that trade-off carefully because Camden, goodness, the democratic structures have been stripped from the city over the years. And so, you know, the conversation is, do you then Is it worth retooling kind of traditional democratic structures to create this new school model that potentially could drive better results? And so where I've ultimately landed on that is there's ultimately nothing more disenfranchising than a student who doesn't graduate from high school. And this is a bet worth making. And we did have some community support, by the way. It's not as though every last person in Camden opposed a Renaissance school. And right now, 2,700 students are enrolled in Renaissance schools and parent and approval is very high and they have wait lists and so on and so forth. So, but I've always been very clear about those trade-offs because I don't want to gloss over them. And I think it's really important to you know, wrap your arms around the drawbacks.
So as opposed to charter schools, these schools, the Renaissance schools, take kids from the neighborhood.
Yes. And so this is something we've done very deliberately and goes against a lot of what you're hearing from the Trump administration where like choice and competition reign supreme. I don't believe in kind of choice for the sake of choice, which is more or less where Betsy DeVos is and vouchers and so on and so forth. I believe that Renaissance schools allow us to provide high quality neighborhood schools. And frankly, that's what Camden families want, especially at the elementary middle school level where there are public safety challenges and you want your kid to be in a building closer to your home. Not every family has a working vehicle. And so, again, you want that school to be in your backyard.
Well, some families still want to see the traditional public school preserved. Why not?
Why do they?
Why not? I mean, we talked about consistency and how, the Renaissance schools seem to chart a steady path toward learning. So that can't happen with your administration, the traditional public schools.
Yeah, the traditional public school is here to stay in Camden. There are fewer better schools today. And so the traditional public school isn't going anywhere. What we've done is while we've opened up more Renaissance schools serving more and more students, on a parallel track, we have improved the traditional public school. And so there was early on some criticism and still some today, but less so, that by trying to do both things, you're limiting the traditional public schools and you're not going to ultimately be able to improve them. And, you know, 3.5 years later, our traditional public schools are fundamentally better by almost every measure, as we've also opened up these additional options, neighborhood options for our families.
Right. Well, back to politics for a moment. You know, the Trump administration's immigration ban has, of course, been making headlines. There was an article in the Enquirer a few days back, which delved into your personal story, Payman Rahanafard. You were at Philadelphia International Airport along with thousands of other people protesting the executive order right after it went into effect the 27th of January because you came to this country, you and your family, as refugees from Iran. So from the perspective of a former refugee who's now an American citizen, how would you characterize the current political climate?
I mean, I think that this is the most divisive political environment in my lifetime. And so it starts there. And the rhetoric has struck me as being about – it's just been more prejudicial and divisive than it has been compassionate and about understanding. And so that's more or less where my head is.
Well, when you were at the protests, did any of your fellow protesters know that they were standing elbow to elbow with the Camden School superintendent? And also, have you gotten any pushback from public officials for your action?
The response in Camden has been incredibly supportive. I was initially reticent to do the story, but I'm glad I did. I hope by telling my personal story, I was able to humanize what feels like fairly inhumane discussion and help humanize the argument against these policies. So, but I'm really grateful to everyone who reached out after the story to express their support. And the combination of those people reaching out and also just the protest itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really beautiful. I my wife and I kind of at the last minute decided we were going to go, and we took our toddler with us. We expected maybe a few hundred people, and we saw in other cities there were big audiences, but you know, it was close to like 5,000 to 7,000 people there. And it was really inspiring and filled me with hope and pride in our country.
Well, let's get to your personal story a little bit more. So in Iran, your family was fleeing religious persecution. Your family's Baha'i.
Mm-hmm.
How did the Islamic regime view the Baha'i faith?
Yeah, the Baha'i faith was deemed heretical, for lack of a better word, for a host of different reasons. Not the least of which being that we believe that all major religions have the same common principles, and that differences in religion have more to do with culture. And so because we believe that, we put Islam in the same boat as Judaism, and so that was deemed to be heretical. And also the Baha'i faith is a younger religion, and Muhammad in the Quran claimed to be the sealer of all prophets, or I believe his exact words. And so, For religious reasons, the religion was persecuted systematically by the government, and I imagine there are some other reasons. And so far as the government wanting to maintain control of the country.
So you spent time in refugee camps before you were able to come to America. You were also very young, what, a few years old?
Yeah, when we arrived here, I was 5 years old.
Do you remember anything of that time?
Yeah, I do. I remember when we first got here and living actually in the Philadelphia area. My grandparents had left 2 years before us. My parents really held out as long as they could. Most Baha'is who were being impacted had left right after the revolution in 1979. Some left, those with means left when the writing was on the wall. So my grandparents got here 2 years earlier, and they were living in Westchester, Pennsylvania at the time. And I definitely remember that pretty well.
Yeah. Well, your mother and your father had professional careers mm-hmm. in Iran. I think your father was an engineer, your mother a chemist.
Right. Yeah. My father worked at a dairy company as an engineer. My mom had a master's in chemistry and just finished up school.
And so when they came to America, that didn't translate. And they had to kind of start. What was your father doing?
So his first job was he worked at a gas station, and then he said to himself, given he can't qualify for these various engineering jobs, that he would just put his skills to use. And so he taught himself how to fix air conditioners, and so he did kind of like a small time door to door air conditioning repair gig for a little while, and then he eventually built a small HVAC business in the Nashville community.
So I've read that your experience influenced your decision to become an educator. How so?
So first and foremost, our family would have encountered a very different fate if it weren't for the compassionate policies of our country. And so we were incredibly grateful to be in the position that we were in. You know, at the same time, we weren't like we came here with the clothes on our back. The government froze our assets. So they not only took all of our personal belongings, our house was robbed, but all of our assets were frozen. And so we got here with no money, no resources. And the conversation I can vividly remember at the breakfast table, and this is my mom especially, was if it weren't for her education, my father's education, they wouldn't have been able to persevere through those challenges and found the wherewithal to start a small business and support their children. And my brother and I, he's 1 year younger, we were very much shielded from all the chaos and turmoil of being in the refugee camp and settling anew. And so that really stuck with me. And as I got older and kind of had a social justice bent in college, studied political science, and I discovered that there are parts of our country where education isn't a guarantee and high quality schools aren't in everyone's backyard. And that really gnawed at me and it made me want to get into education.
So what does that experience bring to your work today as the superintendent of Camden Schools, if anything?
Well, just a reminder that education is freedom and how it literally liberated us and freed us from some pretty chaotic times and really like life or death matters. That starts with the fact that our country let us in. You know, if it weren't for, again, my parents' upbringing and the education they received, we wouldn't have ultimately been able to fight our way to what was a wonderful upbringing my brother and I had. And so that's what sticks with me. And I want to ensure that every child in Camden and our team and our community and our board members and our mayor, and we're all on the same page here, that that's what we want for all children in Camden, that opportunity to graduate from high school and make a choice to go to college or to build a meaningful career right out of high school. And right now that choice is too often made for our students, especially those that aren't leaving prepared with the skills they need. And so we've got a lot of work to do.
Now, what are the joys of the job, Payman Rahanafard?
This is, without question, the most fulfilling job I've ever had and may ever have. Just the opportunity to spend time with our children every single day. I try and go and visit schools or sit down with student roundtables after school or go visit practices. Last night I was at the Camden High basketball game. Just being in the community with our children is the greatest joy of the job. It's really easy to get stuck in the central office when you're the superintendent and there's all this compliance and paperwork you've got to be mindful of. But I make a pretty good effort to be visible and accessible, and that's by far and away the best part of the job.
Now, so if you had a wish list for the next 3 years for the Camden School District, what would be on it?
What would be on the wish list?
Yeah.
That's a really great question. I hope that we can all come together on a big project we're working on, which is the Camden High reconstruction. There are a lot of differing viewpoints on how to go about spending $133 million, which is a good problem to have. But trying to get our community to kind of see eye to eye on it has been a little bit of a challenge. But hey, that's the job. That's right up there. I think better addressing our students' social and emotional learning needs. There's still a lot of work for us to do there. A lot of school buildings I walk into, and I just I know the staff is incredibly hardworking and dedicated, and we've got to provide them better support to make sure that the overall environment of the school is one that our children feel loved and supported. And then third, elevating our work instructionally and ensuring that our teachers have that support as well.
Well, Payman Rahanafard, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Payman Rahanafard is superintendent for the Camden Public School District. And as always, when you get the chance, check out our Facebook page and give it a listen to our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.